You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Andre Agassi is here. He was one of the most popular American athletes of his time and one of the best tennis players of all time. He's won 8 Grand Slam tournaments, the Olympic gold medal for men's singles, and he's one of only 6 men to have achieved a career Grand Slam. He's been known for his unorthodox hairstyles, dress, and attitude on and off the court. So I guess it should come as no surprise that his memoir, called Open, turned out to be just as unorthodox. It's published by Alfred A. Knopf, and I'm very pleased to welcome him to this live broadcast from WNYC's Green Space. Hi.
Thank you. Hello.
you must have been pleased when Time magazine called this perhaps the best sports memoir of all time.
That was pretty overwhelming. I mean, you know, when you pour so much of your life into something, you know, the last 3 years I put thousands of hours into this, and then you sort of add this little nugget on top of that, and you realize it actually is your life, for it to be treated with that kind of, sincerity. It just feels good.
Of all the shocking revelations in this book, and we'll try to talk about as many of them as we can get to, I can't get over you saying repeatedly that you hate tennis. I know that you've talked about this before, but I still wonder, how is it possible for someone who hates tennis to play as well as you do? Is it just a competitive spirit that drove you?
Well, you know, when I started tennis, before I could walk, my father was the one who sort of pushed me into it, and there was never really a choice with my father. And I hated tennis throughout most of my career until I was about 27 years old, where I start to take ownership and I start to choose it for myself. But leading up to that point, I played for my father with a real fear of it, because our family was dramatically affected by how I did on the tennis court or didn't do. And when you're a 7-year-old and you're seeing, you know, your whole family environment getting shifted around based on your results, you start to develop this real conflict with it. And then I moved away to Florida when I was in its tennis academy, which I call a prison. And as a result of doing that, again, I was playing just to escape there, only to find myself on the world stage rebelling and having it, you know, be judged.
But hating tennis, you still played long after most of your peers had retired. Why not retire when you were on the top for the first time?
Well, it's a good question. I think at times I was just flat out scared. I didn't know what else to do. Other times there's this burning desire to inflict pain on myself. And
as you get older, you do inflict more pain on your body, don't you?
You do. The sport gets harder on you for sure. But I think the older you get, and when you still find yourself not knowing who you are, really, I think you get more frustrated by it and everything gets more extreme.
Well, forgive me, but Andre, it still sounds a lot like love for me. You mentioned in the book that when you dealt with the press during those years, you told them what they wanted to hear. Well, how do I know that you're not saying what you think I want to hear?
Yeah, well, that's a fair question. I mean, I think the lies that I told throughout my career typically started as lies to myself. I mean, is it a lie when you don't know yourself, you know, and things come out as half-truths, or you realize later that they're not true? I mean, I'll cite an example that many of us can deal with. When you say, I do, until death do us part, and 2 years later you get divorced, does that mean you lied on that day, or does that mean you really just didn't know yourself? You know, so there was a function of confusion, as a function of fear, as a function of discovery. In a lot of ways that I express myself, that's how it was being perceived, as if it's self-expression, but really it was self-exploration, and things are taken in headlines, and you feel this need to understand yourself. And I hated journalists for a long time, because the truth is they talked about the subject I knew least about, which was me.
Mm. And they were interested in you, and you had quit school when you were very young. You probably, all you knew was the life that you were living, right?
Yeah, I mean, hating school felt like loyalty to my dad, you know, but beyond that, I felt overmatched by school. I never felt prepared for it, always exhausted, but I also realized how much I love learning. My life has been a search for truth.
I spoke some years ago to a violinist who told me that when he was still in his crib, there was a toy violin, and he knew what he was expected to do. There was a mobile of tennis balls over your crib, wasn't there?
Yeah, with a ping pong racket taped to my hand. So, and my dad telling my mom, look, Ma, he's a natural.
Well, every kid will hit at those balls, won't he?
Tell my dad that. Don't tell me that.
Now, you were the youngest of four siblings. Why weren't they pressured to do what you were pressured to do?
They were, and that was part of my fear, watching the relationship, watching tennis interfere with their relationship with my father. You know, I was the last hope, and watching three kind of quickly coming to light that they're not going to make it, they're not going to succeed as a tennis professional, sort of put more of a burden on me, and I showed a bit more talent.
Now, why weren't they? Were they just not physically up to it, or were they rebelling?
My oldest sister, the oldest of all of us, she was actually pretty talented. She lost 7-5 in a third set match one time to Tracy Austin back in the day. She got the top 100 in the world kind of the hard way. She put herself, she paid for it herself, and she didn't want to take anything from my father. But ultimately, she just quit. She had an inner hate conflict with.
It sounds like the Jackson 5.
Oof. Yeah. The Agassi 4. Agassi 4.
Had your father played tennis seriously as a kid?
Not seriously. He loved the game as a kid. He was a Christian Armenian growing up in Muslim Tehran. And the soldiers used to come around back then, and he used to follow these soldiers. And he'd follow them one day to this tennis court in the forest, and he'd watch them hit tennis balls, and he'd go be their ball boy. And one time they gave him a racket, and he always liked it. You know, he was a fighter by nature. You know, his mom kind of was a bit abusive and gave him hand-me-down girls' clothing to wear to school as punishment. And he would fight going to school and fight coming home. And so he put that into some formal training and became a boxer, boxed in 2 Olympics and won 2 Golden Gloves. But he's been fighting his whole life.
And then he really pressured you. I mean, he rigged up this ball machine that has become something of a notorious thing.
Yeah, I refer to it as the Dragon. But, you know, we go on a tennis court, and my dad was a man of math. He loves numbers. He loves geometry. One of the reasons why he loved boxing and tennis is because what I do affects what you do, and angles mean everything. And his numbers was real simple. If I hit 2,500 balls a day, I'll hit this many a week. I'll hit over 1 million balls a year. Nobody can beat a kid that hits over 1 million tennis balls a year. And most of those 1 million tennis balls came out of the belly of this dragon.
Did it help you deal later with on returning service shots?
Anytime you have something hitting the ball at you 110 miles an hour, and my dad would sort of stand behind me and force me to stand on the baseline, the adjustments you have to make really do develop the fundamentals that allow you to adjust to the speed of the game as you get older.
Now, he was forcing you to do this. Was he violent?
He was violent by nature. He wasn't violent on me. But you know, my dad, what I'll say, and I do reconcile to a certain degree our evolution with each other, our relationship. But he's a man that if he understood that I had pain, he would adjust, especially with me, because I was the fourth and he felt some of his relationship slipping with his other kids. The problem with my dad is he never knew you had any pain. It was just, you know, he really didn't, partly because I internalized everything. But the other part, because he just doesn't have a psychology to him. He's, you know, and you have to walk that mile in somebody's shoes to understand who they are.
Have you ever wished that perhaps he had been in love with baseball or basketball or some other a team sport?
I actually was much more suited for a team sport. You know, if I could get out there for somebody else, something that's connected to me but larger than me, I think that would have given me a lot of peace.
My guest is Andre Agassi. His memoir, Open, it's an autobiography, actually, and it's published by Knopf. And we are at the Jerome L. Green space with a wonderful live audience here talking about this book. Didn't your father once try to bet your entire family's fortune on a game between you, a 9-year-old, and Jim Brown, the great football player?
He did. He did, you know. And I got to say, it's a powerful emotion that a young man feels when a boy feels that when their father is so proud of him, but also that believes in him so much. I mean, he thought I could beat everybody.
And well, you couldn't rush 5 yards average as Jim Brown did, but
no,
you probably
couldn't.
Could beat him at tennis.
Well, yeah, you're about to find out. If you read the book, you would know no, I'm kidding. I know you read the book. I walk into my club, a Cambridge Racquet Club, old little, and Jim Brown's in there. He used to always play for money and stuff, and a money match fell through, so he ends up yelling at the manager, you know, you got to get me somebody to play for money. I came here to play and I want to bet. And my dad says, you're looking for a game. My son will play you. And he goes, I only play for money. He goes, he'll play for whatever you want. So how much you want to bet? My dad says, I'll bet you our house. And Jim Brown responds with, I don't need your house. I have a house. What do you say we play for 10 grand? says, fine. So we're about to go on the court. He says, I want to see the money. My dad says, wait here, Andre, drives home, goes in his life savings, and we always kept it basically under a mattress. I mean, it was, he didn't trust banks, he didn't trust anybody. And he comes back with $10,000. And meanwhile, the manager's telling Jim Brown, listen, Jim, this kid's going to beat you, and that's a problem because you won't come back here anymore. So Jim Brown starts assessing me. He starts asking me questions about how often I play, and I tell him I play every day. He says, how often do you win? I go, or lose? I go, I never lose. I mean, I just lose. In my house, losing is not an option. And so he pulls a bet down and says, here's what we'll do. We'll play two sets, and we'll play the third set for money, and we'll decide how much after I get a sense. So I was so relaxed. I went out there, and I kind of dragged him along a little bit because at this point now I wanted some action, right? I didn't want 10,000 worth of action. But so I drag him along, and I beat him pretty handily the first two sets, and then he wants to bet 500, and he bends down and ties his shoes and starts playing a lot better than I, you know, he did the first two sets as well. And
was he setting you up?
He was. So I, you know, I just kind of clicked up a couple notches, and he can only click up one, and I gave him a beating.
Serves him right. You met a kid named Perry playing the junior tournaments who became a friend for life. What did you have in common? Was his father also pressuring him?
Yeah, you know, he's at 11 years old, became my best friend. His father was a lot like mine, except his had a little bit of a difference. Perry never felt the love and that kind of pride that the father had in him. So I think we bonded over that.
Many of the people that you became close to, like your former wife, Brooke Shields, Steffi Graf, your current wife, had driving, difficult parents, and that was true of Perry as well. Do you find yourself connecting with those kinds of people?
Well, I think you gravitate towards people that have a real empathy. And
all so, missed childhoods.
Yeah, there's an empathy for what that feels like, no question. And you recognize it, you know. I see somebody, and you recognize those qualities. I can't say it's necessary to have that kind of relationship in my life, but I sure picked a good one now. I mean, Steph is she's just an incredible foundation in my life.
Still, you didn't have a real childhood, and when you went off to that academy, the Bolitari Academy, you describe it as Lord of the Flies with tennis rackets.
You know, when you take a bunch of teenagers who have no role models, nobody around, nobody to look up to, nobody to help teach, and you say, go raise yourself, and by the way, here's some tennis rackets and some tennis courts, and figure life out, and all of a sudden how you do on that court becomes the pecking order in life. All of a sudden results come with a real weight that you never felt before, and then you end up just turning into animals, really. I mean, the things we would do to each other and around each other was pretty... it was out of control.
And you didn't bother with the academic side of school?
No. So Bolitari's, it was 4 hours of school, and then it was about 6 hours of tennis. And you're always too tired, really. I mean, it's a system that's rigged. It's rigged to create great players and horrible students. And I don't like things that are rigged. I'm from Vegas. I've seen the house win too many times.
Just one more thing before we go into a break. You traveled with your brother, Philly, who was trying to turn pro. How did he feel about the fact that you, his younger brother, could beat him?
Well, that's the thing. You know,
this is a sibling rivalry issue,
yeah,
isn't it?
It is, which is what one of the things that made me realize what this book really is. It's a love letter to the people in my life, the people that taught me, the people that helped believe in me, the people that believed in me when I didn't believe in myself. His generosity really showed most in that dynamic, because he embraced who I was and how I was evolving.
Do you ever wonder what it's like to be one of the Williams sisters? Because they play each other all the time at a very high level.
Yeah, I do, and it actually was really uncomfortable for me to watch for many years until you saw how they handled it. And when you saw their comfort, it helped you a little bit, but I never could comprehend that feeling. It happened to me once with my brother on a practice court, and I swear it was one of the worst days of my life.
We're broadcasting live from the Jerome L. Green space, and we're with Andre Agassi. His autobiography, Open, is published by Knopf. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. We're back with Andre Agassi. He's written an autobiography called Open, and it's published by Knopf. In 1986, you were just 16 years old, and you reached a final in a Masters tournament and the opportunity to go pro. Why did you hesitate?
I never saw myself as a tennis professional. I wasn't choosing it, and I found myself in this situation where I just won $1,100, and that made a big difference. And so here's this check, and if I accept it, I turn pro. And I call home, talk to, my dad, and he said, what the hell else are you going to do, be a doctor? And
was a convincing argument?
Well, he was making a good point. I didn't like the way he was making it, but I thought to myself, what would I do? I'm not prepared for anything. The lack of education in my life certainly gave me limited, if no, options. And that was the whole point, though, when I turned pro, just I would never know at that point. It was a big decision, but it was the only one I felt like I could make.
Well, wasn't it also exciting? I mean, you played your first U.S. Open that year. You coming to New York.
No, it's quite honestly, New York I didn't like. New York intimidated me. It was very overwhelming to me. I didn't like the smells. I didn't like the behaviors. I didn't like, I didn't like the distraction that it was. It was. I didn't understand it. I came from a little town in a desert, and then spent my teenage years in Bradenton, Florida. This is New York was something I did not understand.
But you were going to some of the largest cities in the world and playing before huge crowds. Was the U.S. Open your first Grand Slam?
My first Grand Slam was Wimbledon. I played Wimbledon in 1980. What was it, 86?
And you dislike Wimbledon
very much.
Why?
Because I was alien. I mean, the place was alien. It was one of the tournaments that I never understood. First of all, they cared about what I wore. Mm-hmm. They actually cared about my rebellion, and I didn't get it. I just was like, why would somebody care about what I choose to wear or not? Plus, you felt like an intruder in the very tournament that you're competing in. I mean, if you weren't ranked or seeded, or you hadn't won the tournament before, you couldn't practice on these courts. You had to go down the street, practice over there, and driving on the other side of the road. Whew.
Well, I get the feeling tennis is not the most collegial sport. Everybody recognizes that someday they're going to be playing you and they don't want to be friendly.
Well, I was a bit of an outcast in many respects for certain reasons. The way I dressed, it wasn't normal. The way I acted certainly wasn't normal. It was people didn't know if this was a good thing for tennis or not. And combine that with the fact that a lot of players had a history with my coach, Nick Bollettieri, who was also had a reputation that left me a little bit alienated. I started to avoid locker rooms. I would go to the tournament director's office and I would change clothes in there and get ready in there because I just was in a prison. I just was trying to be away from the players. I was trying to just do what I didn't really want to do, and I was trying to leave as fast as I could.
And you were the youngest in the top 100.
Yeah, and I was also 16 years old, which didn't make people too kind of me.
Wimbledon was also grass. Did that matter?
Grass is a big adjustment. It didn't even feel like tennis. When you do something your whole life and then you go do it on grass, all of a sudden you feel like you've never done this your whole life. I mean, the grass felt real slippery. You're tiptoeing around, the ball's sliding around, and you literally feel like you're playing a different sport. So that was off-putting.
You've always loved playing at Stratton Mountain, and you say that you played above your level there. Why?
Yeah, Stratton I identified. It felt like quintessential America to me. It just felt like, if it was a happy place. People were very friendly, and we spoke the same language, and, the air felt cleaner, and I would calm down. And plus, it would come after the pain of sort of Wimbledon and the French Open, so it came at a great time of the year, just such a welcomed relief.
And that's where you face Ivan Lendl in the final. That had to be intimidating.
I played him in the semifinals there. He was number one in the world. It was the first time that I realized that, geez, I mean, I might be able to actually be number one in the world.
And you say that you knew in the locker room that he was going to beat you.
Yeah.
Why? Because he was walking around naked?
he had this way about him. He'd walk into the locker room and he'd be standing there. The only thing on was his tennis shoes, and you think
that's
strange. Yeah, that's confident. He had a lot to be confident about, let me tell you.
What was his comment about you after he beat you?
When
that kid walks around naked, I'll know he's really scary.
Yeah. No, he said after the match, you know, and I thought, geez, I took him to 3 sets, and he barely got over the finish line against me, and I thought he was going to say some nice things, and basically said, I'm a haircut and a forehand. That's what I am out there. And I thought, ouch.
There's a lot of mean stuff said here. You say a few mean things about other players as well. Is that part of that world?
Yeah, you know, this book is written in present tense, and one of the reasons why I chose to do that is because I wanted somebody to see a 7-year-old talk about their father, what they feel. I wanted to bring somebody into my head. I wanted somebody out there on the court with me. I wanted somebody to understand what you're going through. And one of those things, too, is the heat of battle. And the heat of battle causes you to think pretty crazy things.
Well, your father put a lot of pressure on you, and then people were calling you the savior of American tennis. That had to be a lot of pressure.
I didn't understand the context of how I fit into any of it, but that started to frame a role, you know, this role that I had to kind of live up to and play to, and that was a great fear of mine, is always kind of failing. I think part of the inspiration of this book is learning how to fully commit despite the fear of failure, and I found myself scared to not be this person that I felt like I needed to be or was told I was, and through that conflict, I think I ran into a lot of, a lot of anxiety.
And then around that time, you started losing your hair. How old were you?
I questioned it at 17. I kind of had to admit that it was going at 18. And at 19, I had a window of time to do something about it before everybody could tell.
Uh-huh. And so you started wearing a hairpiece.
No, I lied about that part of the book. I'm just kidding. I wore a hairpiece and had a few traumatic experiences with it. But, you know, what better way to hide who you really are than wearing a mullet?
Now, what happens when you're playing and the crowd is with your opponent? For example, were you upset at the U.S. Open quarterfinals when the crowd was pulling for Connors?
Yeah. It's one of the reasons why I talk about it. You know, this book is a reduction of my life, and you try to take these central pieces and you try to, anything that was formative in my life, and that was really formative because you're on a big stage and you're exposed, you know, you're all by yourself out there, and then you're being judged on top of it, and you're not just judged, you're being labeled. You know, it's one of the things that I think adults do with children is we stick labels on them. We treat them like they're done growing, like somehow this is who you are, when in fact we're always in process. And so that moment on the tennis court when I sort of got called a punk, it was one of the many things that created that angst about me.
Well, you did tell Connors that when you were younger, you delivered rackets to him in Las Vegas.
Yeah, in the locker room before him, my dad used to string his rackets, and I used to take it to him.
But he wasn't nice to you.
Yeah, that's an understatement. I I've spoken to Jimmy 7 minutes in my life, and 5 of them came when I was 7 years old. But I asked him about if he remembered. He just said no. And I said, well, I reminded him. He said, sorry, don't remember. Could be gamesmanship. I didn't know what it was. So I started asking other players around, like, what's up with Jimmy? I mean, you know, here's the story. And then the older players that sort of took me a bit under their wing would go on with their takes on Jimmy. And that was formative, too. It's why I put that in the book, because, well, it doesn't read really nice. That's the harsh reality. When you grow up and you idolize somebody, you look up to somebody, you finally get a chance to be in the arena with them, and then this is what you see and this is what you feel, and this is what you hear. It destroys an image that you have, and that creates its own form.
I'm talking with Andre Agassi, who played tennis professionally from 1986 to 2006. That's a long career. And he talks about it and other matters in his autobiography called Open. It's published by Knopf. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Can we talk a bit about Brooke Shields, your first wife? She went to Princeton. You never really graduated from high school. Was that one of the problems in that marriage?
She probably thought so. I thought I was making a step up, but she was certainly going backwards.
Well, yeah. How did you meet her?
I met through a mutual friend, Kenny G, the saxophonist, and his wife knew her and said that we should meet, and we did.
your initial courtship was a little like an online relationship. You were communicating by fax much of the time.
Yeah, she was in a little hut in South Africa filming some movie, and there was no phones there, apparently. This is before the day and age of certainly cell phones, and so we were faxing each other.
And she's the person who recommended that you get rid of the hairpiece?
She was.
That was good advice.
That was great advice.
That must have made the marriage worthwhile just all in itself.
You know, that was certainly a takeaway that I was grateful for. But, you know, I wouldn't have had a choice sooner or later with the hair. But, you know, she supported me through that. And when you know, a supermodel graduates Princeton tells you that you'll still be cute without the hair, it gives you a lot of confidence.
So did it free you as a player? Was it a coincidence that you won the 1995 Australian Open? That was your first bald slam, wasn't it?
First bald slam. It just shows you how important aerodynamics are out there. it was liberating. When all of a sudden you feel like you're not sort of living a lie, and when there's parts of yourself that you're getting more comfortable with, I think it's liberating.
And you won against Pete Sampras. Sampras was a constant in your career, wasn't he?
He was. It was always Pete, every Sunday.
You weren't friends either.
And there was a lot of times I would look at the draw and I would see everybody I had to play, and the only thing I would know is if I beat everybody I have to play, there's going to be Pete. So, we spent a lot of Sundays together, but you know, we never really knew each other. We're two entirely different people.
Didn't you once bring a parrot to a joint interview with you and Pete?
Yeah, we actually did it in my room where I sort of had a travel with a bird. I was looking for any companions, really, I mean, out there. And then I'd listen to Pete do the interviews, and part of me said, geez, he's better than the parrot. Just with the sound bites that he would give, and I always felt so distant from, you know, him as a player and as a person. You know, I never understood his lack of need for inspiration. And at times in my life, I really envied it. I really wanted it, because lack of inspiration in my life came with such a heavy price. If I wasn't inspired, I could spiral and I could get distracted, and I was always looking for meaning.
Is that why your career was a lot of peaks and valleys? Most athletes reach a high point. They play at that level for a while, and then as age catches up with them, they may go into decline. But you were going up and down all along.
Yeah, well, I had to keep you interested, right? I mean, no, listen, the up and down was a brutal experience for me. It was a byproduct of sort of me trying to come to terms with myself. And, you know, we all have conflicts that we have to reconcile in our own life, and mine was just being played out on a world stage.
Well, how much were you driven by your feelings about the other players, like Boris Becker, another person you didn't particularly like? You faced him in the semis in the 1995 U.S. Open.
Yeah, and again, this is in context of, you know, Boris and I have had some beers and laughs about it since, but you know, in the summer of 1995, Boris beat me in Wimbledon and said these personal things about me afterwards, talked about how I'm an elitist and players really don't like me, a lot of personal stuff, and it hit a nerve, because it's just another example, magnified the angst that I had being out there and the life that I didn't want or choose, and I turned those emotions into anger that summer, and I call it the summer of revenge.
Now, we have to address the drugs issue, even though I'm sure you're tired of talking about it.
Not really,
by now.
Actually.
Well, yesterday, Marat Safin said that you should give back your titles.
You can have every title I won on that stuff or around that stuff. It was in 1997. I was falling to 141 in the world, pulling out of everything in a complete depression in my life. Somebody came along and offered me an escape, and I took it, and I failed a recreational drug in my system. And anybody that has a recreational drug in their system in a competitive environment should be penalized for sure. At the same time, there should be a little bit of awareness that just maybe this person has a problem. I wasn't hurting anybody else.
And this wasn't a performance-enhancing drug. No. You were not taking steroids.
No.
This You're is taking crystal methamphetamine, meth. Yeah. Which is a terrible drug
it
for your
body. It destroys lives. It destroys your body. You can't physically play on it. If you get out there, you could possibly die with the slightest raise of your pulse, not to mention how you're going to calm down, even hit a second serve. That's not a function. Never played on it.
We don't have much time, but I want to read some of the questions that our audience has sent up. Is your father still alive? And if so, what's his reaction to the book?
Oh, I had a great conversation with him the other day. You'll appreciate this. He said to me, I said, Dad, they're sensationalizing a lot of things. Maybe we should talk about it because I know you told me you're not reading the book. Hey, I don't care what people say. I'll be gone tomorrow. That's not a problem. Here's what I care about. If I did this again, I would do the same stuff. And except it wouldn't be tennis. It would be baseball or golf. Because you can play it longer, and you can make more money.
And he'd probably been talking to Tiger Woods' family. Father, you know. Yeah. Because of your own and Steffi's experience with overbearing parents, what are you doing with your children to avoid or develop their interests and talents?
Well, we're giving them options, and I'm a stickler for one thing, which is seeing it through. You know, I define success for my child by peace of heart, and you're not going to have peace of heart unless you care about something deeply where you discover who you are and, as a result, learn empathy and learn how to see life through other people's lens. But, you know, my little girl plays tennis 3 days a week, and if she wanted to do it 4 days a week, I would take a big, deep breath because I know where that leads as far as the life ahead of her if she heads down. But we support them in their choice.
This one asks, what advice would you give to a teenage rising tennis star who finds himself ambivalent about his chosen career as you were?
What I would say is I've reduced it to 400 pages because, experience what I lived. Experience the pains of being labeled, experience the pains of not being connected to what it is you do, and find the tools on how to take ownership of your own life and choose your life.
Just one more thing, back to the drugs. Is tennis cleaner than most sports? I would imagine that there are other recreational drug users among tennis players because this is such a stressful life.
Well, drugs is a real part of our world, let alone just sports is a part of our world. We are the cleanest, I believe. I mean, in 19...
Well, how do people take care of the stress? How do they deal with the stress?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't identify with athletes. A lot of them sort of represent themselves as not having the stress, which has always made me wonder if they're lying or if really I'm just that different. But 1997 was the infancy of our testing. 1999, we went to WADA, which is a world anti-doping agency who test me personally 150 times and out of competition and everything. We go to the absolute lengths to make sure we protect the integrity of sports.
Does it bother you that you probably don't take drugs anymore and nobody's testing you?
if I can help one person, what people think of me is secondary.
Andre Agassi's autobiography, Open, is published by Knopf. We are broadcasting live from the Jerome L. Green Space, WNYC. And thank you so much, Andre, for being with us.
Thank you.